We have a Zen story about the three pure precepts, sort of. One time, somebody came to the Zen teacher Dong Lin and said, "What's the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma?" As Zen people often like to ask. And Dong Lin said something like, "Refrain from all evil or harm and devotedly do all good," which is one way of putting the first two of the three pure precepts, as we talked about. Sometimes we say embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, but that's like refraining from all unwholesomeness. And we say embracing and sustaining good qualities, that's devotedly doing all good. So he said this. This is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma, refraining from all harm, doing all good. And the questioner said, "Well, even a three-year-old knows that." And Dong Lin said, "Well, yeah, a three-year-old may know it, but an 80-year-old has a hard time practicing it." Isn't it true? Anyone of any age has a hard time practicing, really, refraining from all harmfulness and doing all good. Simple, very, very simple teaching, but hard to practice. So we have these encouragements of the ancestors. There's another Zen anecdote about, sort of indirectly again, about the three pure precepts. So this is a Baijiang, who is the one who established the kind of like pure standards for Zen communities. We call Shingi, the first one supposedly to come up with this kind of like particularly Zen ways of practicing in harmony together, was Baijiang, or Hyakujo. You might know through the fox story, right? Which is about cause and effect, right? So he was, that story is particularly about not being blind to the workings of cause and effect, which is kind of like the precepts. So there was something like in the early days of Chan in China that the it wasn't yet its own particular school, the Zen school, so they would, people who were had a kind of Zen orientation would hang out in monasteries of other schools, like the Vinaya school, which would kind of emphasize the more narrow vehicle precepts. So Baijiang was, and he felt like maybe we're a little out of place because we have a different orientation than the monastery we're hanging out in. So what can we do about this? So this is in Baijiang's pure standards, attributed to Baijiang. He says, "I wish to see the way of the Zen ancestors spread and awaken limitless people. We must consider what's the best way of conduct to achieve this goal." And as he was contemplating that with the community, a student came forward and said, "The Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts are taught in Asanga's Yogacara Bhumi treatise." So when you look for like any, in the huge Zen canon, any time it mentions Asanga's Yogacara Bhumi, I think this is maybe the one reference ever made to it. But it's, so there we have it though, a story about Baijiang, where a Zen student says, he knows about this treatise that we're studying, and he says, some Zen nerd. They didn't have so many other Zen you know, Bodhisattva precepts texts, maybe. So we know this Indian Mahayana treatise on the Bodhisattva, on the three pure precepts, which is the teaching. So he said, what about the three pure precepts? Maybe they didn't even think of like the 10 precepts yet. I think they did have that in Bhajang's time, but he said, well, what about following these three pure precepts? That can be our Zen pure standards. He said the Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts are taught in the Sangha's Yogacara Bhumi treatise and the Bodhisattva Jewel Necklace Sutra, which, as I mentioned, maybe the first class. This is not yet translated into English, but it also talks about the three pure precepts in a sutra that was probably written in China. So the student says, why not follow those precepts? Why not have that be our practice? And Bhajang replied, for our Zen school, the guiding principles should not be limited by the precepts of either the Hinayana or Mahayana, the small vehicle or the great vehicle attitude, nor should they differ from these. They should not be limited to either of these approaches, nor differ from these approaches. We must find a middle way that synthesizes the spirit of both and goes beyond both in establishing standards that are most appropriate to our Zen style of practice.
Where is that
quote? It's in the large record of transmission of the lamp in the Bhajang section. And so some people say, Zen ancestor koans and stories in the Bhajang section, they're like, well, Bhajang's one of the most important things for him is establishing this. So this is, they include this like half page summary of Bhajang standards. So this may be that came later. And I don't think it's in Andy Ferguson's book, this section. But where did I have it? Actually, you know where it's quoted? Is in Dogen's Ehe Koroku.
What's that?
Yeah. Now, what section in there is it? I found it in another book. This is a book called Shifting Shape, Shifting Text, Shifting Shape, Shaping Text by Stephen Hine that I think is about the fox koan. It's a Zen book about Bhajang and the fox, and it's the appendix. He has the whole text, which is kind of nice because he talks about this kind of early version of how the Zen monasteries were set up. And the function of the abbot and things like this, all in like one page. But it's all. But this little part that I quoted is in the Ehe Shingi, and it's the section about breathing in Zazen. I don't think I wrote down. The section in that huge. But if you look up Asanga. I think it has a list of, in the index, has a list of all the teachers mentioned, and I think it might list a Sangha. Dogen, of course, does his Dogen thing with that passage. So that's also, and Suzuki Roshi, I heard, said something like, We have Hinayana practice with Mahayana mind. And I think that might be inspired by this Bhajang section where we keep this, you know, kind of like upright standards of conduct that might look a little bit small vehicle. Again, small vehicle here isn't referring to some school of Buddhism. It's referring to my understanding. It's referring to this kind of smaller-minded approach that's just about one's own liberation. But we do. We practice that conduct. It's like, I'm going to concentrate on my practice, and just go straight ahead like this. So, and but we do that with a Mahayana mind, like we're doing this straight ahead way for all beings. That's a nice way to think of practice.
Quick question. How did all these Indian texts, treatises, get to China?
Yeah, they slowly made their way, just like the Chinese ones slowly making their way to America.
Yes.
And, you know, translated gradually. Mm-hmm. And
Some apparently not still.
But many, many of Indian treatises were translated to Chinese early on, and that was an important part of transmitting Dharma to a new country, was the Dharma, Dharma text have to be translated and conveyed and presented, because it's a this lineage of these teachings. We're not just making it up new. And then we will change it based on those teachings. So the texts are really important. And Xuanzang was one of the greatest translators ever. Chinese Bodhisattva who went to India and collected a bunch of these texts and came back, and then I think got a whole council of translators working with him. And this was maybe around like 400 or 500.
Oh, really? So before Bodhidharma?
Before Bodhidharma, yeah.
Wow.
I think that was around the time. And he was particularly interested in Yogacara,
yeah,
the mind-only teachings, which Asanga is the founder. Mm-hmm. So this three pure precepts, mm-hmm, and Asanga's text that we're studying was translated by Xuanzang. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who took the Indian, you know, precepts of like Pratimoksha Sambhara Shila, mm-hmm, and translated that into Chinese as embracing and sustaining standards of conduct. Mm-hmm. So the version of the three pure precepts that Dogen uses in Chinese, mm-hmm, is actually coming from Xuanzang. Mm-hmm. We have this connection to Xuanzang. Because he could have it was just somewhat like creative translation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's Xuanzang. Also the Heart Sutra that we chant in Zen in Japan and America is Xuanzang's translation. And when we were on this India pilgrimage, many places of these pilgrimage sites we went had these plaques that say, Xuanzang came through here in like 384, you know, like maybe in America it says like, on the East Coast anyway, the town I grew up in, it said, Paul Revere rode by this
yeah,
section of town. In India, they say, Xuanzang rode by here on a horse.
Xuanzang translated from what to what?
Sanskrit to Chinese. So he had to learn Sanskrit. And he went to all these Indian pilgrimage sites, and some of them have maps of Xuanzang's journey. Sometimes you see pictures of him where he's walking along with his robes with this giant backpack that looks like a kind of modern, like, REI backpack. Mm-hmm. It's like a frame, external frame backpack, but it's like filled with sutras. It's like all these stacked sutras. And he's walking along over land. So this was one of the things he brought.
Did he know Asanga? Because they're almost contemporaries.
Not that far apart, huh?
Really?
Yeah. Again, I don't remember the dates of Xuanzang exactly, but that's true. Not so much later, right? All this stuff was fresh and new in India, and maybe that's why he came to India and people were like totally into this Bodhisattva movement and these new teachings, mm-hmm, coming from Maitreya and Asanga. Xuanzang was like, oh, we better bring this stuff back to China. We talked a lot last week about the first pure precept of embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, which Asanga says refers to the Hinayana precepts. That's one way he talks about it. These seven different groups of lay and monastic people that were ordained with these precepts since Buddha's time. And so this is Tenzin Roshi talking about this first pure precept, which he, in Being Upright, he translates as embracing and sustaining forms and ceremonies. Which is kind of this approach of like, you just do the forms really well. How does that benefit beings? Well, it's not emphasizing so much benefit beings. It's more like this, taking care of this conduct to train your own mind, which will benefit beings.
But isn't that the one associated with the avoid all evil?
Yes.
The first one?
Yes.
So very different kind of
understanding. Yeah, yeah.
Which is related to our conversation we were having at Key, that there's a variety of different ways that one could think about avoid all evil as just one.
Yeah.
So there's Tenshin Roshi translating that as maintaining
ceremony. Well, he's translating from Xuanzang.
Right, so it's kind of a
Dogen and Xuanzang is literally, I put the Chinese characters on here. It's pretty literal, that first character that means embrace and or sustain or gather. And Ritsu is like Vinaya, is what's used to translate Vinaya, but also we could say forms. Sometimes he translates it as regulations. And Gi, this is Gi on the cover, is, he says ceremonies, but like you could say manners or conduct. And he talks about it in the book somewhere where he says, this part of the character means meaning, and this is person. So like, a person, gives meaning to their, their life through their conduct. Maybe that's not exactly what he says. You can find it in here. But it is an interesting etymology. Meaning or purpose. Here it is. Attaining the way is ceremonies. This pictograph for ceremony on the cover of the book has the radicals for meaning and person. Thus, ceremony brings meaning to the person, and the person embodies meaning. A ceremony is a concert or a dance between person and meaning. So he says this character can be translated as right conduct, loyal, faithful, public-spirited, or duty to one's neighbor, which is interesting. Often means like just conduct or manners. It's in Fukan Zazengi, which is kind of like the manners or conduct for practicing Zazen. Or he likes to translate the ceremony for practicing Zazen. So there's a section where he's talking about this first pure precept, where he says, Tenshin Roshi says, the forms and ceremonies of the Buddha ancestors are just their everyday activities, often compared to eating rice and drinking tea. When you're living, working, and playing beyond the monastic setting, however, you might wonder how to practice the precept of embracing and sustaining forms and ceremonies. Because it's kind of like this formal, temple, monastic kind of emphasis. The same with Vinaya, Pratimoksha precepts are that way. So how do you practice in situations where these traditional forms are impractical? How can you set up forms appropriate to your everyday activities? Once I taught a class on this first pure precept to a group of Zen students living as householders, practicing regularly with an urban sitting group. One woman tried to practice this precept in her daily life by doing whatever she was doing wholeheartedly with complete awareness. I told her that that sounded good. It sounded like the upright practice of this first pure precept in her everyday life. "But I have a question for you," I said. "How do you know that you're not just dreaming that you're doing whatever you're doing wholeheartedly with complete awareness?" And he goes on, "With whom do you establish the standards of practice in your daily life? The ancestors warned us not to set up standards on our own. Without support, how do you know you're not practicing according to your dispositions and going along with your prejudices? In order to practice this precept, we all need someone in our lives to whom we're accountable, someone whom we've asked to give us feedback on our practice, someone to guide us in finding a balance in the midst of our likes and dislikes. Whether you live inside or outside a monastery, you need this kind of support in your practice. You need to take refuge in Sangha. Get together with Dharma friends and agree upon ways that you can help one another practice being upright and intimate with the forms and ceremonies of daily life. If you've already established standards of appropriate conduct, then be sure that you have an understanding of accountability with your friends so you can support one another to realize balance and intimacy with these forms. If you can establish and sustain such standards and Dharma friendships, then you can practice the first pure precept and realize selflessness just as it's done in Zen monasteries." So that's a nice point for a lay practice community, which I think we do quite well. I mean, right now we're doing it, right? Here we're gathered together, talking about the precepts together. Yes.
What is the reference point for seeking feedback? There's our own kind of gauging. We have good internal gauge of it feels like things are harmful or not harmful, but really I need to be open to feedback. But just finding those processes within yourself, letting go of your own. We have a definition of me, so even receiving feedback is continuing to let go of the idea of me, I think. Or it seems like there's just testing ground after testing ground of how to receive feedback.
Yes, yeah. And that reminds me of the first class we talked about, the very beginning of Asanga's text, where he says the essence of precepts is these four qualities, and one is receiving the precepts from someone else, and one is to have a pure intention. And it's kind of like that. We have our own internal conscience, as Asanga mentions. He calls shame and embarrassment. We talked about this. But we could say self-respect and conscience. So maybe in this case, self-respect is like our own sense of what is in accord with harmony with all beings. And then the feedback part is like the conscience or the a kind of more social group understanding, and that we feel, you know, one is that we feel, what maintains the precept is we feel not so good if we go against our internal sense of what's right and wrong. And the other aspect is if we receive from someone else, or we have this kind of agreement with somebody else, then we feel not so good because we have the agreement with them. And that's the kind of, and it's sort of like feedback. And I think that's just the example here, but we could say not just the one we received them from, but like, you know, Sangha in general. And there's no set thing. It's always evolving what's appropriate and not. And we'll never completely agree on like all things, so we just listen to the whole, all different versions and together.
I'm thinking, even if unfortunately you find yourself in a situation where you didn't have a Sangha,
mm-hmm.
but you used two things. One, Liz's idea of a sense not in the mind but somehow in
your own conscience.
That we trust.
Yeah.
That there is a Buddha mind there.
Mm-hmm.
But that will tell us. And the other thing that I think you would have to use if I didn't have all of you guys is if I'm intent on really becoming a person who does no harm and is actually benevolent, I can learn from watching other people's. I can find out what works and doesn't work.
Yeah.
With how other people react to me without even having the sangha, because if I really pay attention, I see this isn't working. I'm not getting, let's say, what I want, which is a smile back.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Or
whatever. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a good point. Be more aware of interactions with others, and I would also add in that I don't think it has to be a Buddha Dharma Sangha. It could just be even Roshi says anybody. It could be like a spouse or a close friend. That's someone who cares about you.
Yeah.
That you're willing to receive feedback from. They don't have to be a practitioner.
Right.
This is nice in the Dharma Sangha. That we have more shared understanding of what practice is, and we have this whole tradition to help with. But I think it could be anybody, actually, especially anybody that also has a conscience themselves. If somebody's like, "Well,
you know," it's like you just did something, you know, and you got them angry.
Mm.
Conscience or not. That was not something you wanted to do. You didn't use skillful means. That you just got some real important feedback about it. It is great when, my friend Kalila, who's not a Buddhist, she's a Sufi, but she's smart, and she's always saying, "Now you're being judgmental." And you know, she really, you know, and I kind of pardon it. Says, you know, I am not. I know. I'm just talking about cause and effect. But she's always on me, and I always take a moment when I'm calm just to say, please don't stop that. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Often we don't, when it first comes, we resist it and defend ourselves, and then later, I know I have that pattern, later it sinks in.
Yeah.
Takes a while.
A while.
You know. Even if we don't agree, I don't think we have to agree with someone, but it's feedback just means we're hearing numerous different voices.
And for at least a moment, letting go of that assumption we made, or you know, that right or wrong we were holding on to, that's being questioned, whether we decided, no, I'm still going to hold on to it or not, to open for that moment to see, someone's questioning it.
Yeah.
Another being.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Let's mm-hmm. do that.
We're at least open to,
Even if it sounds crazy.
So, the structure of this, if I rewrote this, I would put in little headings at these different sections to see how it's broken up, because there is an order here. This is the beginning's kind of an introduction, and then at the beginning of the middle of the first page, where what is complete precepts, that's the introducing the three pure precepts, and then the next little paragraph below that, among them the standards of conduct, that precept, is that short little paragraph is the whole commentary in this case on the first pure precept. The next paragraph, the last paragraph on page one, is a commentary on the second pure precept, and then the first paragraph on page two is a commentary on the third pure precept. And then a sangha is going to do like the elaborate version of each of the three for a while now, for several pages. So if you want it, you can even, if you have a pen and the paper here, you can see the first, after the space there, the first two paragraphs are on the first precept of standards of conduct. The next one paragraph, the bottom of last one on page two, is on the second pure precept, embracing good qualities. And then starting on the top of page three, all the way through page three, and all the way through page four, down to the last paragraph, just before the last paragraph, is all on the third preceptor.
No wonder I like that one so much.
Yeah.
Until the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it is interesting there just how much attention a sangha gives to each. So in his first summary of each, he only gives like one sentence to the first one. He says, it's just these lay and monastic precepts from old times. And then he's going to elaborate a little more here. But he's really giving the most attention to embracing and sustaining all beings. Because it's a bodhisattva text. So I thought we could just jump in at the beginning of the first precept on page 2. This is the middle of page 2 after the space. And he doesn't, you know, I kind of put in numbers because at the end of each one they said there's 10 aspects of this, there's 10 aspects of the first, there's 10 of the second, and there's 11 of the third. And you can kind of go through and find how it's broken down. So maybe I can just mention it as we go through. Standards of conduct precept, or forms and ceremonies precept, is the bodhisattva is concerned about his own faults and errors, not those of others. Of course, but pretty hard, huh? you know, to always keep turning it back on ourselves. There's, I think, what was it? Dharma quotes are always floating around Facebook, right? So I just shared a week or so ago, the Dalai Lama said something like, if you're always thinking about other people's problems, you will suffer. It was basically that simple. And then I think some, as on Facebook, people comment, right? And somebody said something like, if you're thinking about problems at all, you will suffer. And then somebody commented, if you're thinking, you will suffer. So, you know, some dharma gets, you know, floats around Facebook. Some little, like, Zen sparring. Yeah, if you are, you will suffer, right? If there is, I think I might have even wrote that. If there is you, you will suffer. Yeah, yeah. I think that was how we ended it, actually. But here, basically, just Bodhisattva doesn't resent other immoral beings. It doesn't, you know, we talk about this regularly, right? Doesn't mean we like say it doesn't matter what they're doing, but we keep turning it back on ourselves, and we don't get really worked up about other people's faults. And this first pure precept. Later we'll hear some other ways. It's not that simple, right? So there's some other things bodhisattvas do too. But
can we just not let go of that one just for a second?
Well, how about wait till we get to the last one where bodhisattvas are actually like admonishing others and helping them to reform. It's in here.
Yeah.
But it comes in the third pure precept. So it's an emphasis, I think, on these different precepts. And there's a lot of overlap between them. But I think the first one is mostly about our own conduct. So that's what we're paying attention to.
Yeah, you used the term in the last class about stabilizing one's own experience as, not that it's linear, but that part of being able to serve others is to have this ability to not be, you know, this last fall at Tassajara, Christina called it, she said, don't meddle. She said, start with this one.
Yeah.
Even though the whole practice period was about Sangha, mm-hmm. for the first half of the practice period, she said, look at your own mind.
Yep.
Be in your own body. Don't meddle.
Mm-hmm.
Let everybody have their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then, once that was stable, now let's start paying attention to how we're encountering.
Yeah. So I think it is. We do start with that.
I mean, the
order is intentional.
Foundation.
Also, in regard to the foundation. In regard to the great overlap between them, when you start reading them, there's One of the old Indian commentaries says the second precept, to do all good, is done to increase one's own merit. But if it's practiced with the primary intention to help others, it is the third precept of benefiting others. So it's about the intention. Doing good, there's doing good, and then there's, I've even heard one English translation of these, I don't know who came up with this, but avoid all evil, do good, and do good for others. Maybe Berkeley Zen Center or something? Which is kind of aligned with these commentaries. This old commentary even says, even if it fails to actually benefit other beings, if it's done with the primary intention to benefit others, it falls into this third pure precept. So we have this first thing of concern about one's own faults and errors. The second aspect is not becoming angry at others because one's been struck by a clump of earth or a club, or basically when misunderstanding other beings come and hurt us, the Bodhisattva practices patience. So the first one is kind of like honesty with oneself, humility and honesty with oneself. Second is like patience when harm comes to us. The third is the Bodhisattva is endowed with vigilance, comprised by these five limbs, which without going into the details, it's, you know, kind of like the four right efforts, abandoning unwholesomeness, preventing unwholesomeness, doing good, and maintaining good. That is actually the four right efforts in the early teachings, and this is very similar. So we have patience and diligence are two of the paramitas here, but in this case it's really just training oneself. If we're
willful attention.
Yeah, vigilance. Yeah, with one's own conduct. And then if we're looking at the list of ten, it's down in the next paragraph, not showing off virtues is how I would understand the fourth. The fifth is making a pure avowal of faults, confessing and repenting. Six is easily satisfied and content, not complaining why don't you people give me more? Seven is thinking nothing of suffering and being free from anxiety. Nine's not being...
Thinks nothing of suffering.
I think it means of one's own. Not being too upset by our own suffering. I think, again, patience with our own suffering. It's a little, some of the language is a little funny, but being patient with both harm from others and being patient with suffering, which actually are in the paramitas. They're sometimes said patience has these three aspects. Patience with suffering in general. Patience with the particular suffering that's the harm from other people. And patience with the emptiness of all things. It's kind of hard to be patient with it. I think it's literally like the patience with the non-arising of anything. What? Nothing's really happening? Okay, just be patient with this. That nothing has ever happened. letting go and patiently accepting. Accepting is another. And frivolous and not wavering. Not being frivolous and not wavering. And calm deportment is nine, and free from all factors of wrong livelihood, beginning with hypocrisy, which I think refers to since there's various pratimoksha precepts for the monk's livelihood is just receiving offerings. So there's all these precepts around monks have to be very careful not to be hypocritical, like say, you should give a lot of offerings to me because I have great realization. So, you know, I deserve a lot of offerings. And that the other monks that you're giving to over there, they, you know, their practice and realization is not so developed. So that's like, this is like major, major precepts for monastics in the first pure precept. So we call it, I think that's where it might be, hypocrisy around for livelihood. These 10 branches, okay, are the first pure precept. Really just, you know, kind of internal training one's own body and mind. Nobody else might not even notice. So moving on to the second, the precept of embracing good qualities, the last paragraph. One is, the bodhisattva will not allow himself to pay even scant regard to bodily comforts and enjoyments. What need to mention a great deal? Which is kind of like was already in there in the first. So this is, again, you know, we don't want to misunderstand this. This is not about like not taking care of ourselves. But in old India, maybe there's this emphasis of let's not put too much attention into like our own comfort. Let's be comfortable, but let's not overdo it. Maybe we might say. She will not allow any occurrence of defilement or subsidiary defilement, anger or ill will. So, refraining from anger and ill will, bodhisattva's practice. Not allowing enmity, resentment, and spite towards others, very similar. Not allowing laziness and indolence. Not allowing indulgence even in the blissful taste of meditation. So it's like, well, I'm not into like, you know, good food and comfortable beds and so on, but I'm really into like the bliss of like of the jhanas meditation. No, they don't indulge in that bliss either. So it's actually quite similar, it sounds like, to the first pure precept. But this is doing all good, gathering merit. Then these five topics are basically just thinking about virtue and precepts, the advantages, which are basically happiness and ultimately complete awakening, and the causes of virtue are like right conduct and the bodhisattva precepts, and the distortions are like the commentaries mention, you know, false views, like everything is permanent and there's an abiding self, and so these basic wrong views of Dharma are actually start causing the undermining the bodhisattva precepts. And that's basically just kind of a summary, doing all good here. Oh, and then at the end, the last sentence, that is to say, bodhisattvas, or I guess it's actually all good is collected by the common grounds of giving, ethics, patience, vigor, and meditation, and the five aspects of wisdom. Yeah, so the six paramitas, which in other places they mention, that's particularly, I think that's a nice summary of what is embracing and sustaining all good. It's practicing the six paramitas, which we know of in our practice. And Tsongkhapa's commentary on this, we have his commentary on this whole treatise of a Sangha. He says, there's nothing wholesome that's not included in the six paramitas.
Mm-hmm. So, humor and playfulness.
Mm-hmm. That might be, I think you might put that into the Dana paramita, giving joy to others through humor and playfulness. That's the paramita I would put it in. Where would you put it?
I would feel it's a spontaneous reaction to the absurdity and the paradox of the world.
But if it's an offering of goodness to others, even consciously or unconsciously, if we had to put it into one of the six, you're arguing there's some things outside the six. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying it doesn't necessarily have to do anything with others. Uh-huh. It's just a spontaneous bubbling up of can't help but just laugh or sometimes be playful, you know, like real kind of.
And that's if that's embracing and sustaining all good, then I would say, well then let's call it, this is an offering to others of our joy and playfulness.
We just don't want to link for that.
Yeah.
So in the elaboration, I was totally getting the difference between one and two before, and now in the elaboration, I'm like, I agree.
I think this thing about the six paramitas, I think that makes them clearer thing, because you could say these are really, particularly the first three paramitas, giving especially. Even to summarize, giving isn't listed in the first pure precept, because it's like almost like there aren't even any others in this first one. We're just paying attention to our own conduct. And the second one was actually like, that's the primary way to kind of generate merit, is giving in all kinds of ways, and that's doing all good. And then a lot of the benefiting beings also is going to talk a lot about giving, but we might again make this distinction between two and three by saying giving to just generate merit for our own practice is the second precept, and giving just for the sake of like benefiting beings is the third. And just one word about this merit issue, because we talked about this in Sesshin, and for people who weren't here, this is coming from, actually, I think originally from a conversation with one of my Tibetan teachers just in this January about this issue. What is this generating merit thing? And he said, any like wholesome action that benefits others and doesn't harm others is generating merit. So, you know, we often say, well, making offerings of incense and we're chanting the sutra generates merit, and then we dedicate that merit. So there's these kind of formal practices, but you could look at all those as just wholesome activity, beneficial activity, but particularly like giving to others and keeping precepts and so on, is generating merit just because it's anything that's just wholesome. And then reflecting on this further, why do we call that generating merit? And what is this teaching that particularly Mahayana teaching, that on the Bodhisattva path, it said the Bodhisattvas have to generate a lot of merit and wisdom. It's like these two sides. Bodhisattva path is sometimes just broken into these two sides, generating merit and wisdom. Sometimes they say accumulating. We talked about that in Sesshin. Without getting into that, let's just say generating. Giving rise to, producing, creating merit, which is generating merit is wholesome activity, the merit that's generated is the result of wholesome activity. And what is the result of wholesome activity?
Happiness.
Yeah, that was the conclusion I came to. Yeah, happiness. So part of the Bodhisattva path is to become really happy. It benefits others, actually, to be happy in this particular way of like, by doing good, creates genuine true happiness, and that and then we can take that merit. This is a little bit like my kind of contemplation about this. I came to that conclusion. If we call it happiness and well-being, genuine well-being, you can take that well-being and you can like dedicate it, or you can like offer it to others. I think that's like our well-being ceremony, where like let's do something positive, let's feel, rejoice in that, feel good about this, and then our positive energy, let's like, this is the kind of imaginary part maybe, sometimes we like imagine, I wish all beings to feel this happiness that I have. Mm-hmm. You could call that the transference or dedication of merit.
Or the giveaway.
The giveaway, giving merit away. And as is talked about in the teachings about merit, the more you give away merit, the more it increases, which completely goes with this teaching.
The
But in the sutras, like Prajnaparamita sutras, where they talk a lot about this merit, it sounds much more mysterious. They don't say it's just this well-being and happiness from good. It's almost like this scorecard or like this collection, this kind of like fluid, jar full of merit that you're trying to accumulate, an ocean of merit, and it's like some substance that you can like trade back and forth. You can gather more and you can give some away, but then you can get some more. But if we just look at it as well-being and happiness, it's very simple, I think. So you could say, and the purpose of, you could say one purpose of why the bodhisattvas have to generate this is not so much an end in itself, but it's more like from this basis of happiness and well-being, then we can really, we're not so concerned about getting more happiness ourselves, so then we're more available and giving to others, right? I think that might be the principle here. So you could say the first one, we are actually concerned with ourselves. We're getting grounded and stable. We're not like lashing out, practicing calmly being here. Then we start to get happier and happier by doing good, by giving, but we're actually giving here just to develop our own happiness and well-being. And now with this basis of happiness and well-being, now we can go to the third pure precept. Now we can start giving, no longer to increase our own happiness, but just for others' happiness. That's sort of a one way to look at the sequence of these three. But Helen has a good point that you can see a lot of similarities between one and two. You can see a lot of similarities between two and three. But we can see these different nuances. Now, the top of page three is this long, elaborated version of benefiting beings. There's 11 modes by which bodhisattva is established in the precept of benefiting sentient beings.
You didn't say saving beings.
No, in the Indian and the Chinese, it's more like benefit.
No.
Doesn't say.
There you go.
I knew it. Mm. I knew it was a wrong.
In the Sangha, it says benefit, but if we look at what is it in our since you're bringing it up, so that we have the Chinese on page one here, it's this third one, and you can see the first one says literally it's like abundantly benefit sentient beings precept. Oh no, actually, you're right. It actually doesn't say save. It says embrace and sustain sentient beings. We do have the Bodhisattva vow of I vow to save all beings. That one does have the character for, we've talked about this before, right? You could translate it as save or cross over. It means paramita. It means to like, carry to freedom.
One comment, and I will not belabor this, and I'll let it go. Save has probably caused the world more suffering in its terminology and its use than almost any other word in the world. So that
could be.
It has to be understood why that's not a word that a lot of us would be comfortable with.
Okay. Got it. But here we're talking about just benefiting. No one has a problem.
Yeah.
I hope. Benefiting sentient beings. So, one, these 11 modes are kind of like there's a the whole first paragraph is the first of the 11. Basically rendering assistance in all kinds of ways. Being a traveling companion, employing in good work, guarding property, reconciling divided, nurses the ill, guides the blind, uses sign language for the deaf.
It doesn't say that.
It does. The deaf she makes to understand by hand language. So they must have had some kind of sign language in Asanga's time.
Sure.
in India.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a natural language of all deaf people.
Absolutely.
It's an Akkadic language.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And probably the signs have changed over time.
They're different in different
places. Yeah, different places. But using
language
hands.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Did you mention the festivity?
By the way, just about sign language, I don't know if y'all know, but there's a completely deaf person living at City Center, and he gradually went deaf, and he was Shuso not so long ago, yeah, and apparently did the Shuso question and answer ceremony with sign language. Isn't that amazing? No, sign language. So he had a signer. Yeah. So someone would say, "So," ask a question, and then they go, and then he would sign it back, and they would translate it back. So apparently, it took many hours. It took longer than usual. But yeah, people are practicing this Bodhisattva precept with him to help him hear teachings and give teachings. So, giving, all these kinds of giving. Yes.
Are you skipping? Down? I have a question after the part about the death. And those without limbs, he transports.
Uh-huh.
Those are all like things that
yeah.
he does.
Yeah.
And then it says, she dispels the suffering of involvement
yeah.
and sense desire for sentient beings who suffer. In
yeah.
And there's some like that. And I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Quite
yeah, we need the commentary.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was made clear in Tsongkhapa's commentary that the first one is like material giving and physical giving, mm-hmm. And then when we talk about giving in the paramitas, even we say there's material giving and dharma giving, mm-hmm. giving dharma, mm-hmm. and he says this teaching how to work with. The five hindrances, actually a list of sense desire, ill will, torpor, drowsiness, restlessness, regret, and doubt.
The second one then, or still in the first mode?
Still in the first. Okay.
Rendering
so,
assistance.
Yeah.
The first set. Right? The first mode.
Yeah.
And these are all different
yeah.
ways.
Yeah, right. Rendering assistance. Yeah. And all these practical ways that are really obvious. And then through teaching, Dharma teachings, on the example that gets brought up is these five hindrances to meditation are listed, and yeah, it's funny that it doesn't really explain that clearly. Dispels these hindrances. You could say, does it really work to just teach them about them? But in fact, maybe that is what we need to let go of them. Is first we need to hear about them and notice that they're happening, and then there are antidotes even in the Dharma teachings. So take some work from the recipient to actually do the letting go too, but the Bodhisattva can offer guidance. And you know, these are like, you know, traditional Dharma lists, but even outside of the context of Dharma, a Dharma Sangha, we could still, maybe somebody's really, really angry, and we might be able to, without them knowing that it's like a teaching of Buddha, we can maybe offer some advice on how to work with that. Right? Mm-hmm. It's tricky with anger especially, but if people are open, sometimes there's ways. Yeah.
Can I say,
sure.
I forget who I told this to, but this really struck me. This friend that I have who I love very much, but he likes to kind of goad me about my Buddhism. And so I tend to not share that much with him just because he always wants to argue about things.
Mm.
And at some point, I'm just like, I don't really want to argue about this, you know? You don't have to believe in Buddhism, I don't care. But he said something to me. We were working together last month, and he said to me, and he's never complimented, said this kind of thing to me before. He said, you know, you are the person who's the least reactive of anybody I know, which shocked me because inside me, I feel extremely reactive. But I thought, no, you know what? I've worked on that for about 25 years. And I said, well, thank you. I I try for that. I call it equanimity. And I thought, you know, here's this person who would never, ever acknowledge that anything that I did was positive from Buddhism. But in the same way, not knowing necessarily that it's directly from all that time, the cushion, all the interpersonal stuff, the sangha, that he actually notices the behavior of
the
And that blew my mind. It was kind of encouraging, you know, that even,
Which makes me reminds me of something with my teacher once asking about, well, shouldn't we do various these various practices to set a good example for others? And it was something like, yeah, that's good, but even better way is to like have the fruits of those practices. People don't even see the practices that you're doing, but the fruits of your practices will be an example for others.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like that.
Great.
So
the five hindrances.
Five hindrances is a great teaching, particularly they're hindrances to settling in meditation, and they are sense desire, ill will, torpor and drowsiness are one together, and restlessness and regret are one together, and doubt is the fifth. You know, this is a topic for a whole other conversation, but that little list is a really nice list to work with in Zazen. And I sometimes do that. I'll just kind of run through them, especially if, like, Zazen, like, it's not happening well. Sometimes it's said that, like, when these five hindrances are not operating, that is called concentration. So you can kind of go through, well, which one, if I'm not concentrated, which ones of these are operating? I mean, I think I've kind of experimented with, okay, none of them are operating, but I'm still, maybe we still need like a kind of object of mindfulness. But it goes a long way. And they're taught in order of gross to subtle. So it might be like, you don't have a bunch of sense desire, a bunch of ill will, but like, do you have a little bit of doubt about what you're doing in Zazen? That might be the last one.
The
gross is like sense desire, ill will. So the next paragraph is the second aspect of benefiting beings.
The people on the pilgrimage path, there's people along the way that massage your feet and wash your feet. And so those are the ones that dispels exhaustion from those that are road weary. It gives them a place to stay and massages their feet. Mm-hmm. And I saw that.
Where was that?
Yep.
That's that movie about the about the casino.
Nice. So these are like all kinds of really practical ways. It's nice to hear about this Bodhisattva precept practices massaging feet, right? we usually don't hear that. Now we do. So the second thing is the Bodhisattva teaches sentient beings with relevancy. Two, but this is similar, right, to what we were just talking about, giving Dharma teachings. But particularly here with skill and means, which is teaching in a way, one commentary says, teaching in a way that will not give rise to hostility and cynicism, which is kind of what Kathy was just saying. Her skillful means is to not call this a Buddhist teaching that you should practice, but just be nice. And no one will be hot, that person will not be hostile or cynical. Oh, yeah, this is your Buddhist thing. So it's skillful means, right?
He tries to get rises in you.
Sometimes, you know, it's hiding that it's some practice. So I think very similar to the previous one, particularly you know, we could call this one skillful means, though. Third, next paragraph, the Bodhisattva, seeing an occasion for showing gratitude to sentient beings who've helped him, treats them with respect. So, expressing gratitude. Mm-hmm. So great. It's a Bodhisattva precept of benefiting beings is to say thank you, or greets people saying, come here, you're welcome. Receiving them, offering them a seat and a place to stay, waiting upon them with respect that's either greater than or equal to theirs, but not less. So it's really getting into like, maybe we're sort of matching the how respectful someone's being, and we're sort of matching their respect. And it's interesting because you see, I think in my teacher, like, if people are really, maybe practitioners will relate to him really respectfully bowing, and he'll very respectfully bow back. But if someone's not in that mode and there's, hey, how you doing, Reb? You know, hi, how are you? You know, so he's sort of matching the energy of the person. And if they're being very respectful, we bring that back, but not less respectful than them. Waiting upon people with respect, tending to their needs unsolicited, what need to mention when it's been asked. So even before people ask for something, assessing whether they might need it and offering it. I think, you know, in this Sangha, people are so great with this kind of practices. I think just naturally, you know, people just do so much just without being asked, just, you know, silently offering. And thus we have this incredibly beautiful place. So many people are just taken care of. And with often nobody's asking them to. Right? It's just happening. So I feel so great being able to like express my gratitude to y'all for doing this other one.
Yes. Parked the car and there was a homeless man on a little bench in front of a business, and he wasn't asking for anything, and I didn't offer anything, but I was just so aware of how much privilege I had that I had the car, I had enough money for the meter, and enough money to go shopping. I came back, and he was still sitting there. I was really kind of staying out of the way, but out on the street all day, you know. I thought, would it be helpful to offer some money? No, I didn't.
And sometimes people don't want if they're not asking, but sometimes people really appreciate. And often, I've noticed in those kind of cases, people who aren't asking are often more appreciative when you kind of just go up to them and give something. They're like, they're not expecting it, actually. And the ones expecting, like, yep, that's good, they should have. You know, they're too expectant. But the ones not expecting are, oh, wow. Yeah. Even in India, it was like that. So, tending to those, with those who suffer, guarding from fear, so on. So, expressing gratitude, basically, is the third. The fourth is the next paragraph. The Bodhisattva protects frightened sentient beings from fear. So, again, you know, traditionally these three kinds of giving, I think, is a nice teaching. Material giving, and which would include massaging limbs and so on, you know, physical. Giving dharma and giving fearlessness is one of the three types of giving.
Zombies.
Yeah.
I saw that.
So
I didn't know they had them back then.
So sometimes I've heard.
Is that your translation?
No, that was in there. That's Xuan Song working with us on this. So, giving fearlessness is giving protection from fear, and from sharks. And you know what it is? But zombies, yeah, what do you, is that weird?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, inhuman beings and zombies. So maybe, well, with a child, right? I think we know how that goes. There's a zombie in my closet. What can I do? And you protect them from fear by saying, let's look in there together. Well, I'll hide behind you. We look in. Oh, no, there's no zombie. You just, there's like this precept. Right?
You protected. When you came back to China, the stories of
Xuan Zhang.
Yes, mm-hmm. And having met all these dangers and how the Heart Sutra saved you. So one imagines, I mean, traveling the Silk Road.
Yeah. You know. And also in old and contemporary India, there's much more awareness of zombies and kind of like, you know, invisible beings, mm-hmm. like, you know, all those things. This might be one of those things like Pishat. Chakas and Maharagas and these, you know, all these kind of ogres and invisible celestial beings that aren't necessarily like benevolent. That is just part of the Indian culture. So it might be referring to that too. People are scared of evil demons, ghosts, and
not to mention the beings in the hell realms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might come back to haunt people. Yeah, so all the, any kind of, anything that, whether or not they truly exist, we might say, anything anyone's afraid of, they protect. And there's these kind of standard list of fears, like fear of landlords and overlords, fear of loss of livelihood, fear of loss of reputation, this Buddha teaches some of these fears, fear of public shyness.
Those are the five fears.
Yeah, something like that, right? And or public speaking is sometimes said to be one of the fears. And there was a commentary on this public shyness, and it said some people. This would just be one example, I think. Some people may be afraid in public because of their lack of requisites. Lack of good conduct and lack of something to say. They get into sub lists, right? And requisites is like maybe like a homeless person who it actually mentioned like shabby clothing, like they actually feel like embarrassed, or maybe they're at a party and they're like underdressed, right? And I'm kind of afraid to interact here because I feel out of place. That might be the lack of requisites, and lack of good conduct might be like. Maybe same thing, like, I'm so unmannered, I'm at this high-class party, and I'm just a country bumpkin. and lack of something to say. Well, I'm at a sophisticated party, and everyone's talking about these things. I don't know anything about this. Yeah.
But he doesn't really say how the voice.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, good point. Yeah, we might imagine though, like around the shyness one, we can imagine ways if somebody at a party looks like they're hiding in the corner without, because they're kind of shabby and they look kind of like they can't meet the fancy high class people. Maybe go up to them and just sit with them. Hey, how you doing? And they're like, wow, somebody's talking to me, and then. Meet them on their level, and then they like start talking, and sometimes then they won't stop talking even. So that would be an example there. And
or even when new people come here, and they feel
We can greet them. Later, this will come in more. This thing about
Any kind of meeting situation where you would create a forum where everyone's invited to speak, going around the circle, or let's start with
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Or in a teaching situation.
So since you bring that one up, is there anybody who hasn't spoken yet or like to say something?
Well,
yes.
You haven't spoken.
Don't feel on the spot.
I mean, you're not obliged. We're just trying to practice this precept of giving everybody a chance. Chuck?
He withholds the church.
Mary?
Hot potato seeds.
Are we doing this in a bodhisattva-like way?
Yeah.
Has to be kind of like, you know.
But the intent from all of those is that just, you know, say anything, to ease some, to try to put somebody in.
Yeah, when they're afraid. Yep. And sometimes it actually might be like, if they're afraid of sharks, it might be like offering like a shark cage or something.
Now
go into
public. Where are your
shark cages? Yeah, exactly. If you're swimming, here's a cage. Yeah, there you go. There you go. I'm really afraid of sharks. Well, we make a shark barrier. Some beaches have that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Don't they have like a net?
Really? Sure.
Yeah, so like putting that net would be like, a kind of physical material shark protection. I think it's true that they don't get into the details of how you do, but it's more like we start asking, how can we? It's very detailed.
Well,
protecting from sharks.
The distinction between fear that's useful and functional and fear that's not helping at all. I mean, same thing as, you know, suffering. You know, there's fears that we need. They're genetically every animal.
Oh, yeah. Some fears are good.
Those we really want.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When you're just suffering from fears irrational.
Protecting from fear that you could actually be relieved from, and you could be protected from.
Yeah.
And, but I think Dharma could come in here too. There's some things we're afraid of that actually don't really make sense, and Dharma teaching can help. Like, for example, afraid of death, of dying, when we actually are dying.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not on the list.
No, it's not. But we might add it.
I'm going back to page 2. It's under that first precept, but it's the bodhisattva thinks nothing is suffering and his nature is free from anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
So relating that now to fearlessness.
Yeah.
Anxiety, yeah. So maybe trying to help someone else to be free.
And it's interesting because that's how I had long heard about these three types of giving, and I think this is Tenzin Roshi. Giving material things, giving dharma, and giving fearlessness. And he would, maybe without hearing other commentaries, he would say, when asked, well, how do you give fearlessness? Well, you have to just be fearless yourself. And that's how you convey being fearless. But in a lot of these texts, they actually say more like protection from fear. And I think that traditionally it meant more like you're actually protect, you know, doing these kind of physical things of like, if there's robbers or something, or a murderer around, you actually like take them in and protect them from fear. But this other way, it's more like a practice thing of becoming fearless and demonstrating fearlessness would also be maybe the ultimate protection. So to just go a little bit further through this. 5 is not a new paragraph, but it's after zombies. Furthermore, the bodhisattva relieves the sorrow of sentient beings who suffered a calamity. So, and it talks about all these calamities of losing relatives and friends who've died, and losing property, and all these losses. And again, I thought this is interesting. It doesn't say how. How to relieve their sorrow due to loss, but I think we know a lot of things, right? And people do suffer calamities, and it's hard sometimes, especially when it's serious calamity. How do we? But you know, just offering comfort and being with people.
Presence
is the main one, I think.
And permission to grieve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the news about the family of the people on that airplane. They mentioned that some Buddhist groups were coming.
Was this in Nepal?
No.
In the Malaysia.
In that big airliner from India. 233 people on board. And they have the family members in China who were expecting their arrival in the hotel. And they said some Buddhist groups have gone to meet with them.
To meet with the grievers.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Being with, I think, is, we might say, well, you know, zap people out of their sorrow, but it's not really like that. It's more like allowing sorrow and being with and grieving with and compassion. Yeah. But that's a bodhisattva practice of benefiting beings. And then six is, furthermore, bodhisattva provides requisites, which has already kind of been mentioned. Food and shelter and clothing are the kind of classic necessities of life. I thought it was interesting. Ornaments to those who want ornaments. I was like, well, we need food and shelter, but do we need ornaments? And but the commentary said, it's for those who would be ashamed to not have ornaments. And I think it's kind of, it goes back to like the one, the shy person at the party who's all shabby. It's like, well, here, you know, you're about to, I can't go to the party. Here, you can, here, take my, you can wear my dress. That would be like sort of like an offering, an ornament.
I also like, to those who desire, like, it's just honoring what that,
yeah,
the person desires, yeah, rather than deciding what you,
yes,
need, or yep, just offering what they,
yeah,
sure, them at desire or want, you know, the, like, want, not desire, but because they lack of.
Yeah, but I think maybe just maybe either way. But when you get into like, yeah, unguents and ornaments and stuff and perfumes, it may be that they, yeah, they want. And I think this is an interesting one, that with homeless people, right? Because
yeah,
it's kind of like, we say, well, you know, I'll get you food because I know you need food, or I'll give you something warm, but like, I don't want to give you money because you might buy alcohol or something, or something that you don't really need, and it looks like you need some stuff. But I think there is this spirit of, we leave it up to them. Some people would argue that maybe, but I tend to fall into the side of, they want something, even if it's maybe going to harm them. I mean, if it's really like, give me a gun so I can blow my head off. No, we're just not going to go that far. But we'll give you some money, and I don't know, you might do something unwholesome with it, but I'm just going to give it wholeheartedly. And maybe my spirit of just, here, please, enjoy your life.
Yeah.
Maybe that conveys something that they will use it to really enjoy. So maybe we stop here. No, we didn't get through the list because it's time. And we'll finish. Basically, yeah, 8, 9, 10. Interestingly, if you look ahead on this, 8 is this, get into next time, complying with the expectations of sentient beings is almost a whole page of this subcategory. So, you know, as you can see, it's a kind of unusual, not very Zen-like text, but it's a lot of like, very, gets me thinking about all these very practical, down-to-earth ways to benefit beings. Well, if there's any happiness and well-being, that's the result of any positive actions here tonight or any time we gather together this merit and offer it to others who would like some well-being and happiness all throughout the universe. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become him.